And I want to thank the organizers to let me speak here, and in general, the Fields Institute to let me be here for the entire semester doing some work. And as you saw, I just changed the title, and the reason is I don't want to get into equivalent things. I don't want to even define that. And I'm basically going to talk about cubical tessellation, so I changed it for cubical, and everything is okay. And this is, generally speaking, ongoing work. So Mark is going to give, as Peter was saying, a second part of this. But there are still a lot of things that are not done yet. In particular, if you don't like the word twistoids and you have a good suggestion of how to call these things, we're welcome to. Well, Asia doesn't want to change the name of these things, but the rest of us are open to suggestions. And this is to work with Asia and Daniel in general, and then we started with Alan Orbanich from University of Ljubljana, and recently Alan is not working with us right now, but Mark is on these twistoid things. So I'm going to start by defining a twistoid, and for that I'm going to take a tessellation of the Euclidean space, and I'm going to ask this tessellation to be with classical polytopes. In general, I'm going to want, this is a tessellation that I'm going to look at the most, or the square one, but in general I can allow for these things to happen, so for the polytopes not to be convex. But I do want classical polytopes and finite polytopes. And I want the tessellation to be in a face-to-face manner. So whenever I have two polytopes, two cells of my tessellation, if they do intersect, then they intersect, the interiors are disjoint and they intersect at a common face. So in a nice way, basically. And I'm gonna say that a flag of a polytope is going to be just a maximal subset of pairwise incident faces. So over there I have a cube and a flag. I'm sorry, a flag. So I have the vertex, the edge, and the two face in there. And that's a flag of my polytope, or of my cube. And a flag of my tessellation is going to be just a flag of one of the cells. So I take a cell, and in the cell I take my flag. So this flag, for example, in the square, belongs to the cell down here and also to the cell on top. So in the tessellation, those are two different flags. And I can also say that I face of the tessellation is going to be a face of the polytope, or an end face is just going to be one of the cells of the tessellation. And that's it. So what I'm most interested in are the symmetries of these things. And so a symmetry of the tessellation, I'm going to consider a isometry of the space that preserves my tessellation. And the group is going to be denoted by the automorphism of the tessellation U. And here I have the something similar to the cubical tessellation, and some plane reflection planes, and all of those are automorphisms. And actually the way I drew them is such that those four planes, the reflections on those planes, generate the entire group of this tessellation. So now, with this, I can define a twistoid. So I'm going to take a group G that is going to be a crystallographic group, so in the sense that Egon was talking about, so I have discrete, compact, fundamental region. And I'm going to ask for this group to have no fixed points under the group. So the stabilizer of each point in the Euclidean space, the stabilizer is trivial. So nothing can be fixed. And I want this G to be a subgroup of the automorphism group of the tessellation. So if the tessellation doesn't have such a subgroup, I throw away my tessellation and I'm not going to play with it. So I'm only going to play with tessellations that do have G, a crystallographic group that is fixed point free inside the symmetries of the tessellation. And the quotient of the tessellation under this group is going to be a twistoid. And the word twistoid comes from the fact that in the Euclidean space, the screw motions, we're calling them twists. So a twist is a rotation up and translation at the same time. Those are twists. It's not necessary maximal one. No. No, no. It's just a subgroup in there. Yeah. I don't know. So let me it's I'm doing this quotient is not really kind of I'm doing the I'm not really saying that is the quotient of the automorphism group under the group, but the tessellation under the group. So what I mean roughly is if I have the tessellation by squares and I take G to be the group generated by these two translations, then I can take the translations and I can see the entire G to be, I take this point and all the translations on the intersection of the red and blue lines. So those are all the translations. And the quotient, I can see it just in there, in a fundamental region of the group. And in the fundamental region, I have the blue glued to the glue, the blue and the red glued to the red there. And so in my twistoid, I'm going to say that a face is an orbit of the face of the tessellation. So say I take a face of the tessellation in there. Then I take its orbit under the group G, not under the group U, but G, and then I just see it in my quotient. So that is a face of my twistoid. And likewise, I define a flag. So I just take a flag of my tessellation, and then I see the orbit, and whatever it is in the quotient in there. And what we're going to be most interested on are the symmetries of these things. So a symmetry of the twistoid is going to be a symmetry of the tessellation that normalizes G. And here I'm going to play a little bit with the language. Oh, before I do that, so examples here. So in this twistoid over there, if I rotate on the vertex pi over 4, then I take the square, the red and blue square to this one here with these colors, and that normalizes the group. It sends actually all the translation to the translations, so it's okay. However, if I take this reflection here, that is a reflection, is a symmetry of U, when I actually see what happens to the group G, it sends one of the translations to this other one, and that is not in the group. So it doesn't commute with G, so that is not a symmetry of this particular one. So, let me just see if I can make this work. It's not working. Okay. So what I was saying is that I'm going to play a little bit with, I don't know why this goes like that. It's repeating. Sorry. So what I'm saying is that I'm playing a little bit with the word symmetry here. There you go. And I'm going to say that all the symmetries of the twistoid, I'm going to denote the set of all those things as the symmetry of the twistoid. However, the automorphism group of the twistoid is going to be the symmetries under the quotient of the group. So basically the difference is that if I have this one here, say the translation by the blue one is going to normalize G, right? Because it's on G. So it's going to normalize it. So that's going to be a symmetry. It's going to be an induced symmetry of the twistoid. However, as automorphism is the identity automorphism. So I'm going to talk much more about the symmetry that are induced more than the actual automorphisms. There is a slight difference in there. And we want things that have a lot of symmetry. So I'm going to consider U to be a regular tessellation. And that means that the automorphism group of the tessellation is transitive on the flags. And I want a bit more. I want convex cells. And there are not too many tessellations, regular tessellations with convex cells. So I have the tessellation by cubes in any space. So for n equals 2, I get rid of the 3 here, and I have just 4 squares, 4 around each vertex. That's what this symbol means. And then in higher dimensions, this is just the regular tessellation by cubes in the dimension that it corresponds. Then on the plane, we have two extra tessellations by triangles, 6 at each vertex, and the dual by hexagons, 3 at each vertex. And in R4 or E4, I have two special tessellations. This one here is by cross polytops, three around each edge, and the dual tessellation of that. And I'm gonna consider, at least for this talk, I'm only gonna talk about the 4-4 tessellation and the 4-3-4 tessellation, so squares and cubes, and that's about it. So on the plane, what we have is that there are two groups that I'm gonna be able to quotient with, and I'm using Conway's notation in these terms of O and XX, and just for those of you that don't know what this means, the O group, it's a group generated by two independent translations, so this is on the plane. So this is similar to the one that I put before. I have two independent translations, and the fundamental region is just of this type, and there is nothing more about that. And the XX is generated by two parallel glide reflections, and such that the translation component of the glide reflections is the same. So I have these two glide reflections, and then when I look at the fundamental region, it looks something like this. And so this and this are glued by translation, but this and this are glued with the glide reflection here, so they are opposite. So this is just a plane bottle. So So these two are just going to correspond to maps on the torus or on the Klein bottle, respectively. So these are things that we're familiar with. And let me just talk a little bit about the 4-4 tessellation with G equals O, so that means on the torus. So this is really maps on the torus of type 4-4. And I know that some of you are familiar with this, but I'm going to use similar techniques to consider the cubical tessellation. And for some of you that have no idea what I'm talking about, then this is the maps on the torus of type 4-4. So I need G to be a group of translations. So it's generated by two independent translations. And those translations have to be translations of the square tessellation. So they look like that. So because I have G as a subgroup of the automorphism group of the tessellation, let me just see how the symmetries of the tessellation look like. So the automorphism group of this tessellation is generated by three reflections, and this is really similar to what Egon was talking in the lecture before. So in this case, I have R's, he had rows, I think, so, but I have my R0, R1, and R2 are reflections on those lines, and those three generate the entire group. And it's easy to see that the translation by X, so going that way, and by Y going that way, can be written in terms of this with those words. So the translation subgroup is just generated by those two translations. And then I see that this group is going to send in the tessellation, is going to send every vertex to any other vertex, and every face to any other face. So with this group, I have the tessellation is transitive on vertices and on faces. And so I only need to see how a vertex looks like, the stabilizer of a vertex, and that's going to give me the entire group. So the stabilizer of a vertex here is generated by R1 and R2, and the automorphism group of the tessellation is just the semi-direct product of those two groups. And my group G that I'm quotienting with has to be a subgroup of the translational subgroup, because that's just the way I chose it, right? So because the way the translations are, this means that every translation of the entire tessellation is going to induce a symmetry of the twistoid, because every translation is going to commute with the group G, right? Because our translations and translations commute in general. So everything is really nice because I have a big group there that is going to induce symmetries of my twistoid. So I have that completely subgroup. And then I have the central inversion here that is over there. So it's a half turn about the vertex over there. And it can be written like this in terms of the generators of the group. And that's also always going to induce a symmetry of this thing. Because what it's doing is you take a translation, you take the central inversion, and it's just sending that translation to inverse translation. So it commutes with the group. So these things are things that are always in the symmetry group of my, so on the induced symmetries of my twistoid. So if I want to see what kind of symmetries my twistoid has, well, it's going to be a group of that kind. So it's something that is always going to contain the translations, it's always going to contain chi, and it might be there. So really what I'm looking at are subgroups over there, k, that are in between the generated by chi, that is just the half turn, and the stabilizer of the vertex. And that's it. Those are the groups that are going to generate the symmetries, that are going to induce the symmetries here of my twistoid. So what are the possibilities here? Well, what I do is I take a square, and I'm interested on how the symmetries act on the flux in general, on the flux of the tessellation and on the flux on the twistoids. So I take a square that I'm going to say that is my base square, and I triangulate it there, and each of the triangles represents a flag. So here I have, and this is a flag of the tessellation, I have, say, this triangle here represents a flag that has this vertex, this edge, and this square. And so on, each of the triangles has one vertex, one edge, the face over there. And when I take the half turn, the square goes to this other square. And of course, with the flags. So if I color the flags, then they're going to be colored like this in terms of the orbit. So here, I color each flag with a different color, because in principle, they are all in different orbits. I don't know if they are the same or not. It's going to depend in general on k. But when I start, they might be all in different orbits. Then I take the half turn and the colors. So this flag goes to this flag, so they have the same color. And this one goes to this one, so they have the same color, and so on. And then I take a translation that takes that back, and then I see, and then I see that these two flags really have the same color, these two flags have the same color, and so on. So in a square, instead of having the 8 possible colors, I only have the 4 of them. Okay? And I start translating around, and the tessellation is going to look like this. Right? So again, all the faces look alike, and all the vertices look alike. And it depends on k whether these 4 colors are actually different, or some of them might be the same. So what do I have? Well, if k is just the central inversion, I'm actually going to have the 4 colors, and the squares are going to look like this, and nothing, no colors are identified. However, if I start identifying colors, and I say, okay, here the orange and the green are going to be the same, that actually implies that the purple and the blue are the same, and that looks like this in one square, and that's equivalent to having k, the group generated by the central inversion, and R1. If now I identify green and purple and blue and orange, then it looks like that, and it's equivalent to have this k. If I identify the blue and green, then the purple and the orange are identified, and it looks like that. And here I got rid of the central inversion because it's the square of this over here, so I can get rid of them, of that. And then I can also, of course, identify all of them. So these are the only possibilities that I have. I have these 5 possible subgroup k's, and each of them is going to tell me something about the twistoid. And the generators of G that are going to be giving me the twistoid are going to be closely related to these groups, k. So just really quick, because all of this, most of you already seen it before or know it. So if I have the k is everything, so it looks like that, then there are 2 different families of these toroids or maps, and these are the generating vectors. So I'm writing here the 4-4 for the tessellation, and the generating vectors of the G are given by these 2 vectors or by these 2 vectors. And then similarly, if I have this one, this is the chiral case, so I have chiral polytopes, and they're going to be generated by a vector AB and minus BA, where A and B are different. If I have A and B to be the same, then I'm going to go back to regularity. I'm going to have that extra symmetry that identifies these two flags. So that's that family there. Then the next family is going to be, and as I said, all of these things, because of the way they behave, they were vertex and phase transitive, because the translations were taking me everywhere. The regular and the chiral were also edge transitive, and this is also edge transitive. And the way these ones here, they also belong to two families, similar as the regular case. One of the families with vectors AA and B minus B, and the other one is AB, BA. And again, I want A and B to be different, as if they were the same, I go back to regularity. And these two identify. And then I have the next one that are not edge transitive. They have the two orbits. And the generators are A0 and 0B, or AB, A minus B. Again, A and B different. And finally, I can have the four orbits. And I can write this as AB, C0, with these conditions that basically mean that I don't have extra symmetry. So if I have that A equals B, I'm going to have extra symmetry. If I have that C equals 2A or A over 2, I'm going to have extra symmetry. And then I have this ugly condition here that I don't want to get into the details. But if I don't have this condition, I again, that means that I have extra symmetry here. So I glue things, and these are my five possible cases of 4-4 maps on the top. And that's about it for this. Now, one can do similar things for the 3-6 and 6-3 cases. I'm not going to do it. It's not easy. I mean, it's not difficult to do it. You get four different classes, and that's it. And also, some years ago, maybe 5 years ago, Steve Wilson studied these things on the Klein battle. And this afternoon, Max is going to talk a little bit about them. I don't know how much, but he's going to mention them at least. And so I'm not going to get there. Instead, I want to go into the space. And the space is much more interesting. So it turns out that in the plane, we only had these two groups, these two possible Gs. And in three space, we have 10 different possibilities. So we have many more options here. And the groups, and again, I'm using Conway's notation, but I'm saying what they are. And I'm giving fundamental regions. So those of you that are familiar with Conway's notation, here it is. Those of you that are not, I'm going to really fast go over them. So the first group is just the translation group. So it's generated by three independent translations. And here these are, say, this one, and this one. And the fundamental region here is glue, everything is glue by translation, so I get a torus of one dimension higher. So that's the easy case, and it's going to be the one that I'm going to be really talking about. Then I have this group that is generated by three twists. So here again, twist is a screw motion, and the angle is pi, and the translation part is the same for the three of them. So I have them here, this, this, and this one generate the group. And those three give you this one. And the way this goes is I'm going to identify the back, or the front and the bottom by translation, this and that one by translation. But the top and the bottom I'm going to identify by a twist here, so by a half turn in that way. So that's the fundamental region of that group over there. And then I have this other one. And again, I have this twist here is of 2 pi over 3. This one here, is 2 pi over 6. And they give me one of 2 pi over 2. Now, in this one, the heights are different. And that is given by this symbol here. So the ref twist, they are all parallel. But the translation part here, if the translation part of the red one is 1, the blue one is 2, and the green one is 3. It doesn't matter too much. The fundamental region looks pretty much like the one before. Instead of having a parallelogram, now I have a hexagon, regular hexagon, and it's identified this over here. It's identified with the back by translation. This one is identified by translation with that one. This over here is identified by translation with that one. And finally, bottom and top are identified by a twist of this 2 pi over 6. And then I have this other one. It's really similar. I have now two twists of 2 pi over 3. There are this one and this one. This is a different one that is generated by those two. Then here again, I have that the translation parts are all the same. And the identifications on the fundamental region, again, I have a regular hexagon, and the identifications of the walls are pretty much the same, so by translation, but bottom and top by this twist over here. And then I have a similar situation here for these other two, so generated by two twists of a pi over 2, this and this, and that gives you this one. And then this one is a little different. I have this twist of pi and this one of pi, and that gives you this one. There. And here the translation vectors can be completely different. And the identifications are pretty much the same. The generators tell you. All these six give you orientable manifolds when you do the identification, so the fundamental regions are nice. And then you have four that are going to give you non-orientable things. Here the 2-2 star is generated by two twists of pi over 2. Huh. I think that's 2 pi over 2, right? By this and this, it should be 2 pi over 2, so or just pi. And a glide reflection on this plane that is parallel to these ones here, and the translational vector is the same. And here the way it's identified is that the wall over here and the one over here are identified by translation, but the front and back are identified basically by, you take it that way and then you reflect. So this and here. And similarly with the bottom and top. We translate and then reflect, and we get it there. Then I have this other one, and again I have, again here should be pi, I have two twists, and I have a glide that the plane is now orthogonal to the plane of these ones, and the translation component of the glide goes in that direction instead of on the top direction, and then you can figure out the identifications, I don't care much. Then I have this other one that is generated by two glide reflections on parallel planes with a translation component on different directions, in two independent directions. And finally, I have one that is by two parallel planes, glide reflection on two parallel planes with the translations to the same component, to the same direction. And those are my 10 groups. And the goal of this, starting this twistoids, is to take, and this is what I'm calling cubical for twistoids, I'm taking the tessellation by cubes, and I want to quotient this one by one of these groups. So again, as before, I have the generators of the automorphism group, and the situation is really similar to for the square case, where I can write the x over going over there, y going over there, and z over going over there, the translations like that, and then I have the translational subgroup, and then I see the stabilizer of a vertex, and I can write the automorphism group as a semi-direct product of these two. So the goal is to study what kind of symmetries these things can have, depending on the group that I'm quotienting with. And the group, of course, has to be a subgroup of the automorphism group. And what happens is that all these groups that I just mentioned have generators that are either twists on specific lines or glide reflections on planes, except for the first one that only has translations. That is kind of a part. But the ones that have other things, the directions of these things, of the twists on the planes, are going to be given by the S, by the group S. So this basically means that the lines of twists are going to go with the symmetries of this thing. So are going to go either with the edges of the cubes or with the opposite vertices of a cube or with the midpoints of the edges or things like that. So we can control the directions of these things. Except, of course, in the case where G is just translations. and that's the one that I'm going to be talking about the most for the rest of the hour. So I'm going to take G to be the group, that one. So that is the group that is generated by three independent translations. That is, G is a subgroup of the translational subgroup. And again, I want T to be inside here because, I mean, I'm going to get that. So the translations are always going to generate, they're going to induce symmetries of my twistoid whenever G is a translation subgroup. And again, I can define the central inversion now in this way. So now I didn't draw it because I couldn't, but it's the central inversion in a point is the reflection in the base vertex. And that's also going to give me symmetries of these things. So the scenario that I have is really similar that I had for the square tessellation. And I can take a look at this S, the group S here, and I can see it as a symmetry group of the vertex figure, but really what I want to do is to see it as a group of the cubes, because it's easier to see the cubes than to draw them, and because I have the tessellation by cubes, so everything is nicer. So in the same way as before, I have this groups K. So the induced symmetries of the toroid, and now when G is a translation group, I'm going to say that instead of a twistoid, it's a toroid. And the group K over there is going to tell me what kind of symmetries I can have. So the approach here is a little different. So what we do is instead of trying to first color the flags of the cube and then see which groups correspond to that, I go the other way around. We go the other way around, and what we do is we take that there, and I take the subgroup lattice of the groups K that contain chi. And it looks something like this. So these are all the conjugacy classes of the subgroups K, and that's what I'm going to start studying. So if I zoom in into this, I see that I have a conjugacy class that has R3, and that gives me something that we call 12A, and I'm going to tell you why it's 12A. So if I have the cubes, the first thing is that every time that I have a cube, this central inversion here is going to tell me that the flags of the cube on the faces that we see are the same in the same orbit as the faces that we don't see, right? We just invert. So I can when I'm drawing, I can forget about the back of the cube and I can only see the front of the cube. So if I have that this reflection is there, it actually turns out that I can draw the flags in this way. So because of the translations, having the reflection here is equivalent to having the reflection here. And furthermore, it's equivalent to having a half turn on this line over here in the center of that. So I get that the cube, the orbits of the flags in the cube, instead of having the 24 different ones, I get to 12, and the colors are like this. If I now see this element here, so this element is the rotation among an axis that goes like that, and that one is going to color my flags in this way over here. So I'm going to have 8 orbits of flags. And again, in the same way as for the squares, I have that these things are always cube transitive and vertex transitive, so it's enough to see a cube, and I'm going to get everything from there. So now what we want to see is, well, what if I have the two symmetries over here? So if I have the two symmetries, I'm going to take this lattice, and I'm going to see how far I can go. So if I have this symmetry here, then I'm going to have one of the classes that is on top of this. If I have this symmetry here, I'm going to have a class that is on top of this. And the smallest class that is on top of the two is this two over here. So I might have, if I have this symmetry and this symmetry, I have either this one or this one. And we can actually play with the colors here and with the pictures and say, okay, I'm going to start with a flag, and I want to see what is the orbit of that flag when I have the two symmetries. So first, I color as these two cubes tell me. So the cube over there tells me that this has to be of the same color and this one here tells me that these two have to be on the same color. And then I see, I apply this reflection, and I get those flags in the same one. Then I apply this one, and I get that. And then I apply this one, and I get to there. So what it's telling me is that this two that we saw in the lattice represents these two orbits of flags, and they have to look like this. We might have extra symmetry to have the two of them in the same orbit, right? So they might have the same color. Now, in this case, just by this picture, we can see that, as we knew, the toroid was going to be transitive on vertices and cubes, but here we also have transitivity on edges and squares. So this is a really symmetric case. So I can do this for all the classes. And it turns out that the cubes are going to look pretty much like that. And on the bottom here, I have a 24-orbit one. So basically, all the flags that you see are in different colors. I didn't draw it. So the numbers represent the number of orbits that I have in a cube. And for here, 8, 4, 3, 2, and 1, there is only one possible configuration that I can have this number of orbits. Of course, there's only one possible configuration for the cubes under these circumstances. But 12 and 6, I have for 12 two different configurations, and 6 three possible configurations. So we're just labeling these things by A, B, and C. And that's it. And so, as I said, all classes are transitive on vertices and cubes, but only some of them are transitive on squares and edges. And it turns out that if they are transitive on squares that are also transitive on edges, those are the classes that satisfy that. So we want to see how these things look like, roughly at least. And the regular ones, so those were studied by Peter and Egon about 20 years ago or something like that. And they show that they belong to three different classes. And here, these vectors over here are telling me the generating vectors of the group, right? So roughly the way that they look, this is an easy one to draw, because it's just A0, 0, 0, A0, and 0, it should be 0, 0, A. So it's easy to draw. Then to draw the next one, I'm going to take this over here, and the next one is 2A00, 02A0, and AAA. So I'm going to think now that this over here is 2A, and this over here is 2A. So I can put there an A by A cube, and my generating vectors are going to be the two, this one over here, this one over here, and the one that goes from here to here. So it looks kind of like that. And there I have underlying the cube tessellation over there. So I have two pictures here. I don't know if you can understand anything of any of them, but that's roughly the idea of how they should look like. And then finally, the third class, we have the AA0 and A minus A0 are these two vectors over here. And then I want to see where the last vector is, and it's on the other red point over there. And it looks something roughly like that. So those are the, if the generating vectors are those, then we get regular things. And something that is going to help us a lot to see, to classify all the other ones, to see how the generating vectors have to look like to have extra symmetry, is this of looking at one plane and then the other vector, so to speak, and I'm going to get into more details and where the projections go. So in this one, the projection went to a vertex there of the tessellation. This one, the projection went to the center of this square down below, and then here the same. And that's going to be really helpful for us to study these things in general. So what we do in this case when we have translations is that we take the origin, and I draw the origin there on red, and the picture is two-dimensional, because if I draw it three-dimensional, then I don't see anything anymore. But you can imagine that the cubes are coming this way, if you wish. So if I take the orbit of the origin under the group, I'm going to get a lattice. So I have there the point of the lattice. So these toroids, instead of looking at the translations, I can take a look at the points on the lattice. And I know that the symmetries that are the symmetries of U that induce symmetries of these things are of that type. Now F is going to fix a vertex, so I'm not going to look at those. S is going to fix a vertex, T is going to move things around. So I'm going to take a look at the things that fix a vertex, so the elements of K. And the elements of K fix this vertex. So if they are symmetries, they have to send the lattice to itself. So I'm going to play a little bit with that. So if I have a reflection, the reflection R3, and that was just a reflection on a plane, I can take the origin. And then if I take any other vector in the lattice, and that is not supposed to be on the plane, it's somewhere else, I reflect, and the reflection is also a point of the lattice. So when I sum those two vectors, I get something that is on the lattice, but it's also on the plane that I have, right? So that tells me that every time that I have a lattice invariant under this plane, if I have a point there, I'm going to have a whole bunch of points. And on that plane, I can really see entire lattice, a sub-lattice of my complete lattice. So I can take a look at how that lattice looks like and what is the toroid that is induced. So because I have R3, I picked here R3, and R3 is going to be, when I intersect it with the cubical lattice, I get just the squares. So what I get is really something that is inducing one of the maps that we had before, right? So the approach that we take, and I don't want to get in too many details, but the approach that we take is that we take a look at this lattice, we see what possible classes of that lattice are, and how can this be extended. So the only, really quick, the only thing that I want to do is take a look at the ones that the possibility of having class 2. So on the xy plane, they have to be either of this type or of that type, and that is because of the way the flags are colored over here on the top. So if we see this coloring and we go back to the classification that we have of 4-4 torus, then that means that on the plane there, it has to be either in class 2-0, that is the way that we label, or in the regular class. We don't know, because we don't know. We know that for the cubical thing, these two have to be in different orbits, but we don't know what happens down below. So we take a look at that and say it looks like that. And the entire lattice, the way it's going to look like roughly, is we're going to take copies of this lattice, and we have different layers there. Right? So G is going to be generated by three vectors, and it's going to be either these two and some third one, or these two and some third one. And the first thing that we see is that this class here had the R1, R2 rotation. So when we take this vector, and it's the same for one of this, we just have here one, but it's the same for one of this, I rotate back, and I get it back to a vector that is B00 in here. So that means that really, the underlying tessellations have to be regular. They cannot be two orbit ones. They have to be regular. So they look like that. And then I have a V3 vector here. And what we do is we take V3 to be the closest vector or the closest point on the lattice to the plane here that we have. And we had here that this one was in the lattice. And if we label the vectors V3 as X, Y, D, this sum is 2x, 2y, 0, which means that the projection of this vector here has to be in the middle of the origin with one of the points of the lattice. And that means that when we take a look at the projection of the vector v3, it has to project, depending on which case we have of the underlying tessellation, but it has to project to either a vertex of the tessellation, a midpoint of the fundamental region, or the center of the fundamental region. And so we just take a look at each of the cases, and we start seeing how these things look like. So if it projects here, depending on the height, it can be in class 1 when the height was the same, And if it's something different, it turns out to be in class 3, not in class 2 as we wanted. If it projects here, we have a similar thing. We can never fit it in class 2. One particular value is going to give us class 1, and any other is going to give us 3 orbits. And then finally here, we have that either it's in class 6 for almost all the values, we're going to get 6 orbits. But there is one particular value that is, so if I go here up by this, just there, what happens is that really we get more points of the lattice. So the underlying tessellation was not the red one that I draw first, but all the centers are in the original lattice. So we shouldn't be taking a look at this in this case because it was of the other kind of regular maps. So we take a look at the other ones, and we have something similar. If it's projected here, we have either regular or 3 orbits. If it's projected here, we have either 3 orbits, or for one specific value, we actually have that this had to be a point of the tessellation on the underlying lattice. And similar here, we have either 6 orbits, or if we have one particular value here, we're going to get here, the midpoint here. So this was not really the underlying tessellation. So it turns out that there are no 2-orbit toroids in the cubical lattice. We cannot have that. Now, all the other possible classes, we can have them. So we had a whole bunch of different possibilities, and this is the only one that we cannot have. And we do similar things for classification of the other classes. I'm not going to get into them, but it's kind of the same. We look at something that is invariant under the group, and then we see how that some plane that is invariant, we see how the tessellation looks like there, and we see how it can expand. That's the basic analysis. And I just want to say something really quick, in 5 minutes, about some other groups, and Mark is going to talk much more about this in the afternoon. But let me just remind you, say, for example, I take this group, and it's generated by 3 twists, and that was the fundamental region. And again, I just want to look at things that are cubical. There you go. So only cubical things. So I want to fit this group in the automorphism group of the tessellation. So what this means is that I have to fit half turns, I mean, or twists of pi, in that group. And those axes have to be in a particular direction that the tessellation is going to give us. So, for example, I can take the axis to be parallel to the edges. Now, when we study these things, we get very little symmetry. And one of the reasons is that if we want something that normalizes the group, this twist has to go to another twist of the group. So basically, either I send this red line to another red line, and then as an automorphism, that's going to be either identity or just a translation up, or I have to switch here the axis. But in this particular example, if I have this axis here going through actually an edge or a bunch of edges, I cannot change it for this one here. So in this particular example that I have here a 3x3 tessellation here. So the toroid of here is actually a toroid because it was identified, this wall was identified with that by translation and this by that by translation. So this is a toroid. It's a regular toroid, but most of the symmetries cannot be extended to the twistoid. Basically, because I cannot interchange this point with any of these points. And even if I could interchange them, so like in this case here, even if I could interchange these things, I can never interchange this direction by this direction, right? Because I don't have any twists on this direction. So the symmetries in all the other groups are going to be much less. And in general, we're not going to be able to bound the number of orbits of these things. And this afternoon, Mark is going to talk about two of the groups and of these other groups in much more detail than this. And that's